Hello, friends. I'm Tara Quintana, a board-certified family nurse practitioner and IFM-certified functional medicine specialist who believes in utilizing functional medicine strategies in order to provide a more comprehensive approach for optimal health. The current model of care in healthcare is very lacking, which led me down the road of functional medicine. Functional medicine is a systems biology approach which looks at uncovering the root causes for the symptoms we're having in order to allow for healing versus simply applying a band-aid to the situation. I feel so strongly about this that I had to leave my conventional medicine practice. While conventional medicine thrives with acute care issues, there is much to be desired with regards to chronic conditions. No longer could I practice in an institution where volume of patients rather than optimization of health was its driving force. I started my own practice, specializing in functional medicine, where I work with my clients to uncover their unique story, utilizing the functional medicine timeline and matrix, identifying the antecedents, triggers, and mediators driving the disease process assists with getting to the root causes of the symptoms in order to allow for healing. This personalized approach leads to improved health outcomes. If you want to work with me and live in Indiana, head on over to my website at www.thefunctionalnursepractitioner.com and click the link to book your free introductory call. Just a quick disclaimer that this podcast is meant for educational purposes only and is not meant to diagnose or be a substitute for medical advice from your practitioner. Also, if you like what you hear on the show, I would be real appreciative if you would leave a review and a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening from, and subscribe to the show. Let's dive in. Today, we have a very special guest, Dr. Eric Balcavage. Dr. Eric is a doctor of chiropractic, board certified in integrative medicine, certified functional medicine practitioner, and certified gluten coach. He is the founder and owner of Rejuvigen, a functional medicine practice in Pennsylvania. Dr. Eric is widely recognized around the world as a leader in functional medicine and thyroid physiology. He is so passionate about the thyroid that he co-wrote the book, The Thyroid Debacle, which was published in 2022. In over 20 years of practice, he has successfully helped thousands of people suffering with thyroid problems and other chronic health conditions. Dr. Eric also has a podcast of his own, the Thyroid Answers podcast, where he co-hosts a rather compelling show. I am a fan and have been an avid listener for years. I was listening to one of his recent episodes and was so inspired by that conversation that I had to reach out and bring him on the show. Eric, Dr. Eric, welcome to the Functional Nurse Practitioner podcast.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I am so thrilled to have you on the show today. It's funny, I've been listening to your show for so long that I feel like I know you. I definitely appreciate your passion, Eric. I know you have a story, and I'm sure my listeners would love to hear how, like, the why behind your journey into functional medicine.
Sure. I had really no intention in getting into functional medicine. I wound up, going to college business, I was going to do undergrad, like most kids go, they go off to college and they have no real idea of what they want to do. I was just, somebody gave me money to wrestle. So I went to college and figured I'd figure it out. But a little bit of injury, tragedy, wound up changing schools, had an injured back, wound up meeting chiropractor when I transferred from one college to another, who thought he could, said he could help me. I didn't know anything about chiropractic, and my family said, no, don't go. They're witch doctors. So I made an appointment pretty much the next day. And, within about 3 months, he took me from not really being able to get around very well to be back on the field and playing rugby. And so I wound up continuing to play rugby. When I transferred college, I transferred from a small private school called Gettysburg College to another small state school called Kutztown. And when you transfer like mid-year, there's not a lot of stuff available. So when I transferred, they asked me what I wanted to major in, and I said business. They're like, we don't have any available classes. So I said, well, what does nobody take? And they said, medical technology. I'm like, perfect. That's my new major. And I think they were like, cool. Do you even know what it is? I'm like, no. But at the time, I was working in the hospital. So I worked in the hospital, in the OR. So I was like, yeah, you know, I enjoy working in the hospital, work in the OR. This is kind of lab stuff. Like, how different could it be, right? I'll change it later. But I wound up continuing as a medical technology major. I figured I was going to work, come out and either work as a medical technologist, which I'm sure you're familiar with your background, or go to med school. And I thought, you know, I'm working in the hospital, working there, I'll go off to med school and I'll be a medical physician. And it was my chiropractor who I'd still been seeing all the way through school who convinced me to go to chiropractic school. And he said, you know, you could go to chiropractic school. And I'm like, well, why would I do that? And he's like, well, how's your sinuses? How's your back? How's your, you know, all these issues I had. And I'm like, you know what? I don't have them. And he said, why do you think that is? And I was like, yeah, you know, clean living. And he's like, Eric, you're working full time. You're going to school full time. You're playing rugby and you drink like fish. So it can't be clean living. So I want you to read these books and come back. Don't come back and see me for treatment until you've read all these books. So these you know, green books and books on written by a bunch of the chiropractors on cell health. And I devoured a bunch of these books that he gave me. And I was like, all right, let me consider this. And so I decided I would head off to chiropractic school and be a chiropractor. And you know, the beauty of it was I got to play rugby while I was there and, you know, still had fun and got this degree. And when I came out, I was just going to be a chiropractor. And then one day my brother reached out to me and said, hey, this is what was happening with his wife. She got diagnosed with hypothyroidism, fibroids, and an iron deficiency. You know, and the answer was, we're going to, you know, hysterectomy, iron supplementation, and thyroid medication for the rest of your life, right? And I'm like, you know, what do you want me to do about this? It's not what I do, right? And he's like, I know, you'll figure it out. And, you know, I was like, all right, so let me dig into this. And I had a background, obviously, in lab and blood studies. So I was like, all right, I go back to some of my roots and start looking at labs and trying to figure this out. I started in this journey in functional medicine and took a lot of the courses that the Piece Karazian and Cyrex Labs offered at that point in time, or Apex offered at that point in time. And I did. Dug in deep. And as I'm learning about thyroid physiology to help a family member, you know, I start, you know, in practice as a chiropractor, you're talking to people on a regular basis and you're saying, hey, what's going on? And I didn't realize how many of my clients were on thyroid medication. It just wasn't something I was necessarily dealing with. I was just trying to deal with the structure and nerve component. I wasn't really looking that deep in and putting into consideration that all these people were on thyroid medication. And the more I talked to them, you know, you realize that most of them didn't feel that well. And so I started talking to them about thyroid physiology and, hey, there's this functional medicine thing. And that led me to start taking care of more people from a functional medicine perspective. And I did all the coursework. And, you know, I did that for a number of years doing functional medicine and the chiro stuff. But there was something not quite right about what I was learning. I kind of always thought that maybe it just didn't make sense to me that the body would wake up one day and decide that it forgot how to convert T4 to T3, or that it would all of a sudden it doesn't recognize our own tissue and just destroys it. I struggled with that concept. And it was a friend of mine, Dr. Ben Lynch, who sent me a paper on the cell danger response by Dr. Robert Navio and said, hey, you probably need to read this. And when I read that paper, that was like the light bulb moment for me that, hey, maybe what we're seeing in thyroid physiology is not broken physiology, but adaptive physiology. And that changed the way I looked at patients, how I tried to address them, how I tried to treat them. And when I read that paper, it made so much sense to me. The only thing that was missing is Dr. Navio didn't put anything in there about thyroid physiology. And so when I reached out to him and said, hey, what about thyroid physiology here and all these little things that you talk about? He's like, I don't really know much about thyroid physiology. And I was like, man, it's involved in every step, either directly or indirectly, but it wasn't in his wheelhouse. And that's when my friend Ben said, hey, you're going to have to write a book and talk about it. And it became even more of a reality to me through my own health journeys in my 40s, developing Hashimoto's and other immune issues. And I was living what I thought was a relatively healthy, clean life, right? But then when I sat back and started thinking about what creates that cell stress response, I had a deviated septum. I was exercising. I was training for doing endurance sports and working, kids, coaching, all these things. So I too developed my own Hashimoto's thyroid issue. And when you think about it, you're like, okay, if it's just, it just didn't make sense to me that this was just broken, but I realized that I was creating, even though I didn't think it was, I was creating a lot of stress on my own physiology. And what the reason I'd probably developed Hashimoto's and thyroiditis and reduced conversion was because I was overtaxing my physiology, even though I was doing a lot of things right. I was also doing some things not so great, 4 hours of sleep a night on a regular ongoing basis, poor breath, breathing because of deviated septum, and just the stress of parenting, coaching, business, everything else. It was cumulative, excessive. And by using these principles that we talk about in our book, reduce the stressors and improve the fitness in these categories, I was using those processes to help my patients already. And I used the same principles to help me recover as well.
Well, I love that story. And I feel like it really is going to like hit home with so many people. So many individuals that I work with, I feel like those of us that have went into the realm of autoimmune conditions, there's a common denominator is what I typically see. And like you said, lack of sleep, guilty. I used to say I'll sleep when I'm dead. And then when they were taking my thyroid out, I said, okay, well, something's got to give. Like, my body didn't just self-implode for no reason. And I definitely do not believe we are designed to attack ourselves, that there's a reason behind it, like you said. And that's what I love about functional medicine, because then it's, if we don't get to the actual root causes of the dysfunction and what's going on, the body, I don't believe that the body will truly heal. And then we're simply band-aiding disease processes or symptoms and leading to other symptoms, and people just don't feel better. And I read your book, and frankly, it was really hard to put down. I almost read it in one sitting, and I'm an avid reader, and I've read a lot of books about the thyroid, but I really found that your book was informative. Honestly, I didn't know what to expect. Right. I've been listening to your podcast for so long, but I actually found it surprising. Right. So informative, easy to read. But you talk about, at least in my experience, professionally and personally, things that have the biggest impact, like nutrition, stress, sleep quality. You also spoke about genetics, which I am a fan of looking at genetics. And I know you mentioned previously that you've looked at a lot of genetics and you were deep into the concept of genetics, but there's a naivety about you get your genetic results and here's your bag of supplements then, that, and I couldn't agree with you more with that. That whole pill for the ill really like fires me up. It's the same mentality of allopathic medicine in the functional medicine space. And just for, I feel like this will jive with you. I see a lot of people that have went to numerous other functional medicine practitioners, and they don't have a timeline or matrix. They don't even know what I'm talking about when I mention this, and they have a bucket of supplements, literally 50, 60 supplements. Mm-hmm. They don't feel any better. And I have like a bone to pick with functional medicine practitioners that are using an allopathic method. And I get it, because when I first went into functional medicine, I thought I had lymphoma, which is what they originally told me. So I was looking for, how am I going to survive? My background was actually oncology and hospice and then women's health. So I'm thinking, I don't know if I'm going to make it through that regimen, because I know what is entailed with the regimen. And so that's when I went back to school for functional medicine. And I remember in those early part of that, every class, I was the one in the chat saying, what do I take? What's the supplement? What do I do? And there is no one answer. So if it was that simple, nobody would feel bad. Everybody would be just Perfect. I want to get into cellular physiology, get a little bit more into the cell danger response.
Sure.
But what I see is that a lot of practitioners are looking to normalize labs, but then patients, clients don't feel any better. First, right. Could you describe for the listeners what normal thyroid physiology looks like?
Sure. We have a gland right in the middle of our neck. It's called the thyroid gland, and it produces a number of things. But the two primary things that we think about from a thyroid hormone perspective is the precursor hormone we call T4. It's the dominant hormone that's produced by the thyroid gland. And then there's another hormone that's typically released that we talk about, it, which is T3, which is the active hormone that does most of the work. And there's some other things that are there, T2 and some other things, but these are the two primary hormones that are released from the thyroid gland that support and kind of regulate our metabolism. Once they're released, and I should say, most of what's produced by the thyroid gland is T4, and it's the inactive or less active hormone. And the ratio typically is somewhere around 8-1, 10-1, T4 to T3. And the body does that on purpose, because if we just made all this active hormone and dumped it out into the system, then we'd probably have more hormone getting to certain tissues, upregulating metabolism inappropriately. And so what the body does is produces this less active hormone, and then the cells and tissues can work to convert it to the active hormone as we need, so that we're not totally dependent on the thyroid gland for metabolism, but each cell, each tissue can kind of self-determine its own metabolism. So the thyroid gland makes this T4, T3, somewhere in a ratio of like 10 to 1. The T4 and T3 are released into the bloodstream, and most of it gets bound onto what we call transport proteins. And these are like Uber drivers that then drive the thyroid hormone around the body. And when the thyroid hormone gets to a tissue or a cell that needs thyroid hormone, changes in temperature, changes in pH cause that hormone to be released from that binding globulin and then become what we call free hormone. Now, free T4 or free T3 can then have the potential to get into a cell or tissue. But once it gets to the cell level, then the cell makes a decision as to what happens with that. So a cell that wants to increase its metabolism is going to probably bring in more T4. It's going to bring in more T3. And then that inside the cell, that T4 can be converted to T3. Any T3 that's come in or the T4 that's converted to T3 can then go bind to receptors that turn on the metabolism, turn on the machinery, help us make energy. Proteins, peptides, hormones, all these fantastic things that make us feel good. The other thing that can happen is the cell can determine, may have some, that the cell may not want to increase its metabolism. And so it can deactivate T4 to a molecule called reverse T3. It could deactivate T3 to a form of, to something called T2, and there's a couple different forms of it. And those are, I'd say, less active metabolites, and that can result in reduced metabolism. So that's kind of the physiology. Now, typically what happens is if we need to increase our metabolism, the cells in, and we're in a low stress state, we're in like what we call manufacturing mode. Hey, I need to make enzymes and hormones, or I ate too much food. The body says, whoa, we increase the metabolism to make more stuff or to burn off those extra calories. The body increases more conversion of T4 to T3, and we do this kind of manufacturing processes. We're detoxing, we're burning fat, we're burning fuel, we're doing all these things that make us feel good. And the other primary mode of a cell is really cell defense, meaning that the cell is like, hey, there's a threat response. And so when there's a threat response going on, the cell essentially downregulates the metabolism to reduce that threat from proliferating. If it's an organism, we don't want that organism to thrive. So we want to wall that thing off, find it, kill it, get rid of it. If it's a toxin, we want to reduce our exposure to it. And that's what we call the cell danger response. And the downregulation of thyroid hormone is really critical to activating the cell danger response. So the cell operates either in manufacturing mode when we're in low stress, or it operates in more of a cell defense mechanism if we're perceiving stress or danger. And primary function of what shifts us from manufacturing to cell defense is the amount of T3 inside the cell.
Okay. I want to underscore something that you said about normal thyroid physiology. The cell is going to decide, what am I going to use this thyroid? And there are things, and you said that things, you mentioned pathogens, toxins, that could change the response and produce this cell danger response. Can you speak a little bit more into other things even that could trigger the cell from going into, you know, the manufacturing mode to more of the defense mode?
Sure. I mean, there's lots of things that can do it. And unfortunately, sometimes in social media, you'll hear people say they've found the cause of all hypothyroidism or thyroiditis. Or Hashimoto's. It's H. pylori, or it's yeast, or it's parasites, or whatever, mold, right? Anything that drives an excessive cell stress response can reduce the conversion of P4 to T3. So low oxygen, deviated septum. Just because I have a deviated septum, that has an impact on my ability to regulate oxygen and carbon dioxide to some degree. But if I'm not getting enough oxygen to a tissue, that can create a state of hypoxia. And when there's not enough oxygen in the cell, then that can be a trigger for cell defense, for cell danger. Hey, there's not enough oxygen to run the mitochondria effectively, so we need to slow down the metabolism so we don't create more damage to the tissue. So it's just poor breathing at night. If you're a mouth breather, if you're a snorer, if you've got a deviated septum, if you've got something that makes you more congested and you're breathing through your mouth all night, just that disrupted breathing pattern can be something that reduces the T4 to T3 conversion because it's creating the cell stress response. If you've been diagnosed with sleep apnea, this is part of the problem. You're not getting sufficient oxygen to the tissues. Other things it could be, for sure, how tying breathing, abnormal breathing, abnormal sleep patterns, or disrupted sleep patterns create a stress response. This has clearly been discussed in the literature, and there's tons of papers and books on how disrupted sleep patterns trigger a cell stress response and change our chemistry. And part of one of those changes is when we're not getting enough sleep, when we're not getting enough rest and recovery, is we regulate our sympathetic nervous system, trigger more inflammatory mechanisms, and then that triggers some of that cell stress, cell danger response. So the person who likes to stay up till 4 o'clock in the morning watching videos and movies, and then gets up at 7 o'clock and they're like, hey, like, or they're you or me who's saying, hey, I've got a lot to do. I'll sleep 4 hours a day. And you think that's a badge of honor because, hey, I'll sleep when I'm dead. And I'm just super highly productive, and we can get by, but over time that can contribute to it. You talked about organisms, bacteria, toxins, and it could be anything. I just interviewed somebody on my podcast, and they were talking like, well, yeast can cause thyroiditis. And I'm like, yeah. And so could 100 other organisms. It's not specific. Like that's the only thing, but any organism that's overgrowing or growing in a place where it shouldn't be can trigger a cell stress response. And if it's creating that cell stress response, it can result in reduced conversion of T4 to T3. And those organisms and their toxins can trigger thyroiditis. And then we can talk about that later if you want. Nutrition plays a huge role. What we eat, especially if there's inflammatory foods, chemicals, toxins, and probably one of the biggest things that really can trigger that cell stress response is real or perceived threats and stressors. And so we go through life taking in information into our nervous system. All of that goes up into their brain, and our brain has to determine, is that a threat? Is it not a threat? Is it a threat? Is it not a threat? But if we're constantly in threatening situations, or we're always worried about situations, what we tend to start to do is start to stimulate what we call our limbic system and keep training our brain that we're in constant danger and constant threat. And this results in upregulation of your sympathetic nervous system, downregulation of the parasympathetic nervous system, but these and more of a low-grade inflammatory response. And when our brain is perceiving that we're in constant danger, that's going to trigger a cell stress response because chemicals are going to be released that start saying, hey, we're in danger where there's a threat, whether it's real or perceived. And we can really do a great job of building that muscle up over time to create that cell stress response. So contrary to maybe what a lot of our peers will say, and I think it's more marketing than it's belief, but it's not about the thing as much as it's about the load. And usually the analogy I use, if I had two cinder blocks and I put a 2x4 across there, and it's like, if I think about like 5-pound weights as the stressors of life, if I'm going through life and keep adding stress to that board, at some point I'm going to exceed the capacity of the board to manage the weight. Let's say it's 100 pounds. And we might think that the last 5 pounds I put on it that takes it from 100 to 105 pounds is the thing that broke the board. And everybody gets excited about that. Well, you have Hashimoto's, I just tested your gut, you have H. pylori, therefore H. pylori causes thyroiditis. Well, maybe it's contributing to it, maybe it did cause it, or maybe it is just consequence of chaos, right? Candida is causing your thyroiditis. Maybe it could be, but maybe there's something else creating excessive stress, and the candida, which could be a commensal organism, it's the change in the terrain as a result of this chronic stress response just made it a really healthy environment for candida to grow. So we have to, I think what our job is to help our clients understand what is contributing to your load. What are the things? How's your breathing? How's your respiration? What's your emotional fitness? What's your physical fitness? Is it too much activity, too little? And take a look at all of those things. And that's where a health timeline, our story kind of helps us understand how did we get here? And then what we look to do is say, okay, what are the things contributing to the load? And then what can I do to reduce or eliminate those stressors? So we get to a point where the danger physiology, the body stops thinking it's kind of constant chronic danger and says, okay, danger averted. Now I can start getting back to healing, repairing, and manufacturing.
You know, that is, it's fascinating. And basically, anything and everything could impact our adaptability, right? And
sure.
I love, like, everything's about yeast. Everything's about parasites, or I have mold. That's the answer. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. the reason. That's the reason why this is the way that I am. And no look at, well, like you said, how are you sleeping? How are you eating? How are you pooping? You know, what do you feel? Like if you're eating, what's your state of mind when you're eating? I know for me, when I worked at the hospital, I didn't think about what I was eating at all. I was shoveling it in as I'm doing 100 other things, thinking I'm productive. I can multitask and not thinking about the impact on the rest of my body, not just my thyroid, but everything, right? So I tell people it isn't one thing, it's everything. And it can be overwhelming to look at it that way, but it also makes sense, right? That
yeah, absolutely. Because you can't, we're not going to, and the challenge for somebody who's listening to this here is that they may listen to what you said or I said and say, well, I'm in constant load and stress. It's not about the constant load necessarily. It is, and the things in our environment, some of those things we can't change. We can't eliminate some of those things, but it's about our adaptability, right? So if I do endurance training, I can get healthier. I can get fitter. I can get stronger. But the training can be beneficial unless it's excessive to what I can recover from and I'm not allowing for recovery, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's about adaptability and resilience. And what happens is we have just so much load, good and what we think are good stressors and bad stressors, but we never get a recovery mode, right? We never get a chance to recover from those stressors. And so everything just accumulates, and then we break. And so, you know, simple things can have dramatic impact, and things that we think are healthy could be problematic. So as the listener, if you're like, how am I going to eliminate everything? You're not going to eliminate everything. What do you have to do is make a decision as to what are the things that are the that are having the biggest negative influence on my physiology and not allowing me to kind of get out of this danger response. Is it physical? Is it chemical? Is it emotional? Is it microbial? Is it a bunch of things? How do I reduce the things that are most stressful, most problematic, most toxic to the system to a point that we can reduce the danger physiology? And then as we start to support the recovery of the tissues, then we can get exposure to some toxins, but because the body is resilient, it can deal with them appropriately. We can have some time where we don't sleep optimally. The body's resilient, so we can recover. Like, I can eat some junky food and it doesn't create a lot of symptomatology. I can drink some alcohol periodically and it's not healthy, but it's not going to be devastating to my system. I can go into a house that has mold and that doesn't create a chronic inflammatory or immune response, right? So one of the things we're missing sometimes is that those chronic exposures become chronic, persistent, overload the system. There's no recovery. We just keep pushing through. And as you probably see and I see, as we help people recover, we don't ask, it's often that they're not experiencing less stress. It's that they are more adaptable to the stressors in their environment and actually become stronger. It's like lifting weights. Like every time I do bicep curls, I'm breaking that muscle tissue down. I'm stressing it. I'm breaking it down. That sounds terrible. But if I leave time for recovery and I don't do that day in, day out to the same intensity, that muscle tissue is going to be bigger and stronger tomorrow. So next week, I can increase my weight. Hey, that muscle's like 2.5 pounds stronger now. Hey, that's great. And that's the same for almost all the different stressors that impact our physiology.
Yeah. And so, you know, I've used your board and cinder block. I've used that term. Well, I stole it from you basically for my patients and clients. And I use the term threshold a lot of the times. Like, it, like for me, and I like hand signals because I'm a visual person. I'll say, you know, my body, I met my threshold for what my body could tolerate. And there's numerous things that contributed to that. Mm-hmm. Did I have mold exposure? Yeah. Did I have all these other toxins and making antibodies to dryer sheets, the flame retardant? And I don't even use dryer sheets. So is that the one thing? So if somebody removes that one stressor, everything's going to just be hunky-dory. It wasn't like that for me. And I don't see that for a lot of people. And for me, what I've seen to be the biggest impact for change with the body is what I did last. It is not what I wanted to do. So I have a lot of empathy for everybody that I work with, because the things that are going to move the needle the fastest and the farthest are really hard. At least I think they're hard. They were hard for me.
Are they hard to do? Are they simple? Are they simple things to do?
Yes. Simple, but hard, because it's like a change in mindset where, you know, my conventional medicine training, okay, what are your symptoms? What are your labs? Here's your medication. So somebody has thyroid levels that are not optimal and they have these symptoms and they have mold, you know, put them on a mold protocol. Really don't like that word, protocol. And then, you know, miraculously the mold is gone, give them thyroid medicine and then they're fine, versus, and I'm sarcastic right there, versus what is the whole terrain of your body? How do you feel? What's your health stress? I feel like health stress, that might be like one of the biggest ones, because I'm working with a lot of people who don't feel well. That's why they sought me out, right? Mm-hmm. And they're leveled, all of these monkeys on their back, all their diagnoses are like crushing them, right? That now is just one more thing that I have wrong with me. And why is my body broken? Like, I must have, out of 100, I'm just making this number up, it's around that number, 100 people, right? I tested for Hashimoto's, 2 didn't have it,
right? For years, they've been hypothyroid. So, or not hypothyroid, but just suggestive, like this subclinical mm-hmm. hypothyroidism. And then they're like, you know, my body is attacking myself. Why? Well, I'm broken. Like, you are not broken. There is something going on, and we need to figure out what that is. For me, I was doing all of those things on the bottom of the matrix wrong. I was eating junk. I was also eating every couple of hours because I said, well, I'm hypoglycemic. Didn't think of why. So, and I was eating sweet tarts and Twizzlers. So mm-hmm. those are good for you, right? And not sleeping. And then definitely no stress management. For me, that was probably the hardest one because I didn't want to face like slowing down. I've handled everything through my life, my traumas, my experiences and everything by never stopping, right? Mm-hmm. So when I have an individual in front of me and they're like, it's my estrogen. I hear this a lot, right? Or it's I don't have enough T3, just prescribe T3. Like, well, why don't you have enough? Like you said, if it's an adaptive response, and of course, when I look, the reverse T3 is really high. And when I start talking about why this could be, like what can cause reverse T3? Well, they have mold, let's say exposure to mold and antibodies. Okay, yeah, maybe that can do it. But what about stress? And again, health stress, thinking of the nervous system. So for me, one of my passions is definitely the nervous system. That is, it's not talked about enough. And when I'm talking to somebody who has questions about the thyroid, and then I'm speaking about, you know, taking breaks throughout the day, doing breath work, taking off, you know, their glasses, closing their eyes, going in the dark, they're like, what about my thyroid? Well, the whole body's connected, yeah. Right? And so how do you feel about the whole concept of protocols? Like, well, my doctor said that, you know, it was my T3 that was low. So they put me on a bunch of T3, that's the answer. Even, you know, that they're just not converting. Like, I know I've heard you say that a lot of times. I will add, though, sometimes that is the case that somebody does have that genetic predisposition. I actually see that a lot. It's a predisposition. Doesn't mean we're expressing it. Right.
Yeah. I think the numbers currently it's about 15% of the population, and it can have about a 20% decrease in the amount of T4 to T3 yeah. conversion. So
not 100%.
No, it's not 100%. Which is what I think some people try and promote. But who's the person that maybe has a genetic predisposition is probably the person who's had some struggles with thyroid physiology, whether it's a tissue impact, they probably struggled with hypothyroid signs and symptoms for the better part of their life is the reality. They may have always been a little bit heavier because their metabolism is a little bit slower, always had some of those things that we call kind of chronic hypothyroid signs and symptoms. They may not have, but that's one of the things you take a look at. But how do we determine? Well, we can determine by looking at genetic testing. There are some genetic panels that can be done and some reporting systems that have those genes on them, plus a bunch of other genes that can impact thyroid physiology. And they could be good, but I don't think it's often the time, the place to start for most people.
I couldn't
because
agree.
Everything costs money. And so how do we judiciously use somebody's money and resources? Do we start with a genetic panel? I don't think so. I'm not opposed to it if somebody has unlimited resources, but if they have limited resources, then let's not spend money on something that may not make a huge change. Because if we have somebody that truly has a polymorphism, we will start to see that in their physiology as we start to work with them. And so we don't have to go there. But I don't rule it out as a thing. I probably have 3 panels I'm looking at, I have to look at this weekend of patients. So from that perspective, I think it is a possibility. As far as protocols, I don't have any. I wish there was a protocol, but I don't. I have principles that I keep in mind, and those don't change too much. But protocols, no. So when some of my friends read the book, they're like, "Where's the supplement protocols?" I'm like, "Well, anybody who reads a book." Is that one of the first things they do is go find the supplements and order them all and start taking them. And so that doesn't work. Two, the things that have pushed the needle the most are the foundational concepts that we talk about in part three of the book, the diet, lifestyle, mindset, and we'll talk about the health stress here in a second. And then for us as clinicians, we shouldn't be thinking protocol. We should be thinking interpretation mm-hmm. of labs, and then not trying to, we have to keep in mind that the lab value is not the problem. The lab value is the, is like the signpost that, hey, this value's off. And so if we just try and manipulate it with a drug or a supplement, are we actually creating the issue? If you assume that the body's broken, then maybe that's the right solution. But if you don't assume that, and you assume that that's an adaptive response, then adding more support to something the body was trying to not do in the beginning, it was trying not to do, probably not a great strategy. And I talk about this all the time when it comes to thyroid hormone replacement. I think the amount of people that are on thyroid hormone, T4, T3, T4, T3 combo is way overblown. There's way too many people on thyroid medication. And some of our peers may give me a hard time and say, well, there's a lot of people, there's way more people that have thyroid issues that aren't diagnosed. There's a lot of people that have thyroid physiology changes. They're operating from what we call thyroid allostasis, an adaptive response to some type of stress, but they don't necessarily need thyroid medication. And it should be our job to be able to say, okay, your TSH is elevated, but if I look at your signs and symptoms and I look at the rest of the labs, it would not be appropriate to give you more thyroid hormone because it's the body is trying not to make more thyroid hormone. It's deactivating it. So why would more hormone into a system that doesn't want it make sense? And you've probably heard me say, I talk about this in the book, could be taking more thyroid hormone when the body doesn't want it or need it be potentially problematic? And the answer is yes. Not only can it create negative signs and symptoms, not only can it result in reduced conversion of T4 to T3, but it can also drive abnormal cell development, cancer, tissue damage. And so there are huge problems with over-medicating. And if you'll let me, I'll give you a great example of problems. This was I had a discovery call with a person this week and I just did a Thyroid Thursday on this. Do I need medication number two? And she said, hey, there's 5 years ago, I was in for a checkup. My TSH was like 4 point something. And they had been listening to podcasts and they listened to somebody's podcast that the optimal number for TSH is between 1 and 2. And you have to have it in that range if you're optimized. And the other values were good. Her free T4 was 1.2. I still have it on my whiteboard. Free T3 was 3.2. And her primary care physician said, you do not need thyroid medication. So this person, because they've been listening to functional medicine podcasts and learning about optimal levels, decided that they were going to work with a functional medicine practitioner. And that functional medicine practitioner said, absolutely, you need thyroid medication. We need to get your TSH into the optimal range. But the dogma that one value needs to be in a range then sent this person on a 5-year journey of trying different types of thyroid medication, T4, increased doses, decreased doses, T3, increased doses, decreased doses, T4, T3 combinations. And today, 5 years later, they're still on a combo T4, T3. And their comment was, and they asked me to look at their thyroid values now, the same panel, and TSH is 0.83, free T3 is 0.63, free T3 is 2.8. And so all the values are out of the optimal range now. And she said, we've never found a dose that makes me feel good and has values in optimal range. So what are your thoughts? I'm like, I don't know your health history, but there's no reason you did not need thyroid medication 5 years ago when somebody put you on medication. So if I had the rest of the story, I could give you more data, but for the listener, that TSH was above what somebody might call an optimal range. It wasn't outside the lab range. But even if that TSH was 4.9 or 5, if the free T3, free T4, and I'd like to see a full panel, but if those values are good and the free T3 to free T4 ratio good, person didn't need more hormone. Even though TSH is elevated, there's a lot of reasons TSH could be elevated. Time of the year, the labs were drawn. What was done the day or two before? Were they sick? Did they have it? Did they exercise? Did they fast? Like, what are the other factors that may have influenced? There may have been a number of them, or this could be a person who just has a little bit of higher set point of TSH because, as you talked about before, there are people that have a deiodinase 2 polymorphism. And if they do have a deiodinase 2 polymorphism, the set point for their TSH is going to be higher because they require higher TSH to drive the thyroid gland to make more T3 than it typically would. Instead of that ratio being 10 to 1 T4 to T3, maybe because of that reduced conversion, their TSH stays a bit higher. That drives a different ratio, maybe 8 to 1 or 5 to 1 T4 to T3 to maintain that T3 level. So what the doctor probably did is not know some of this stuff and just started this person on a thyroid replacement strategy or protocol, right? They have a protocol. If it's not in TS, it's not in this range, we give this. And your person's probably been on a 5-year journey of disrupted health because somebody was wearing their blinders within our space, within the functional medicine space, and not understanding the labs, knowing how to interpret them. They were just looking for an H or L outside of their predetermined range and then figuring out, I'm going to hammer this into range, and didn't understand the consequences.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you brought this story up, because I think it really needs to be like underscored, because I appreciate optimal levels. I was trained to look for optimal levels, but not in isolation. You can't just look at a TSH and it's 3.5, let's say, and say, well, it's not optimal, so raise your levels. I want to see a whole panel before I even think before I think about putting anybody on thyroid medicine or changing anything, but then also looking at them and their past and the whole situation. Because correct me if I'm wrong, or maybe you'd like to expand on this concept. Could taking thyroid medicine impact other hormones?
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, taking thyroid hormone medication that's not needed can have impacts on almost every other system. And one of the biggest factors that taking too much thyroid hormone may play the biggest direct impact on is the upregulation of the sympathetic nervous system. So if we oversaturate the body with thyroid hormone via medication that's not needed, especially if there's already a pre-existing stressed state, what happens is we saturate the hypothalamus and the pituitary. Now we upregulate the sympathetic nervous system. Now with an upregulated sympathetic nervous system, more glucose production. We're going to have increased catecholamine production. We're going to potentially start to have, initially we may have increased cortisol, and then in time we may have decreased cortisol. We may see a drop in lipids. We may see a rise in lipids, depending on where we're catching somebody. That may have an impact on biliary function and digestion. It may have an impact on our body's ability to make and regulate sex hormones appropriately. So hyperthyroidism, whether we do it because the gland is just producing too much thyroid hormone, or we do it via medication, creates significant issues. And especially in the case of over-medication in somebody who's got a pre-existing excessive cell stress response going on, not only will it create hyperthyroid symptomatology, but it's likely going to create more hypothyroid symptomatology at the very same time. And yes. So in a traditional, and you know this probably better than me, in a traditional model, they may say, hey, that can't happen, but it absolutely can happen. Absolutely. Because when there's too much T4 in circulation and it's not being converted to T3, that extra T4 in circulation deactivates the enzyme inside cells and tissues that converts T4 to T3. We get T3, this active hormone, via two primary enzymes that convert T4 to T3. One is called deiodinase 2, one's called deiodinase 1. And almost all the cells utilize some T3 from the bloodstream. But a lot of cells use about 50% of the T3 that they take in from T3 that's already in circulation. And the other maybe 40, 50% is from what they convert T4 to T3 inside their cells. And that makes a huge difference. Based on what I've read, when a cell converts to T4 to T3 inside it, that T3 stays at the receptor for close to 8 hours. When we just pull T3 from the bloodstream, it only typically stays in the cell for maybe a half an hour. So think about that when we're thinking about what we're doing. Hey, I'm going to blast somebody with T3 medication. That's not made in the cell. And so that's where somebody might need a lot higher dose. If we're going to give somebody T3 medication, why doesn't the 30 micrograms that they make in a regular day help? Why do they need 60 or 70 or 80 or 90? Well, one of the reasons is it may not last in the cells as long. And two, we're also suppressing the thyroid gland's production, and the half-life of T3 is 12 to 24 hours. And so it doesn't last long. So we need lots in the system. And if it doesn't last in the bloodstream long and it doesn't last in the cell long, then we have to constantly be bombarding the system with it. So I think I got off track on that, but I think important point.
I love that. Actually, with the T3, it's interesting because I have a variant of the deiodinase 2. I didn't know growing up, I had no idea. And then I was hypothyroid. They put me on medication. And when all of this happened, after I did, they took my thyroid out, I was like, not okay. They kept raising my dose. They're like, for somebody my size, I was on 188 micrograms of Synthroid and felt like terrible, horrible, right? So taking T3 helped. I'm not the same. I would never recommend somebody take their thyroid out as a treatment for Hashimoto's, which I have had several clients that happened to them, right? Mine didn't come out because of that. They thought it was cancer, which that's not the first line of treatment for cancer, but I actually couldn't swallow. And my throat, my thyroid became so enlarged, I couldn't eat solid food. And I lost like 15 pounds in a month. And I saw this thyroid specialist who told me the thyroid would never cause problems swallowing. He told me it was all in my head. So that was a really wonderful conventional medicine experience that I had. But for me, I notice I'll almost fall off a cliff halfway through the day because I take a combination. And I split it up into two doses. If I miss the second dose, if I forget, I can tell. And I feel like there's more of a roller coaster, right? Because it's not as stable in the body. Now, I don't have a gland anymore. So I'm relying on exogenous hormones. For somebody that does have a gland, I would rather look to get theirs functioning better so that maybe we could take them off of their medication, right? Because most of the time somebody doesn't feel better on it. And what do you do with the person that has perfect labs, they're on a dose, and they have no improvement with their symptoms? You were mentioning about it getting into the cell. So we could have normal levels, but have what's called this cellular hypothyroidism that I've had numerous specialists, endocrinologists tell me that there's no such thing as cellular hypothyroidism. So I asked them to show me the research that says that, because where they're coming from is from a model from 30 years ago, not from anything that's current. And it just, to me, it doesn't make any sense. And so could you speak a little bit more about this concept of cellular hypothyroidism?
Yeah, I think from a medical perspective, the belief, I don't know if it's a belief or just the dogma that they follow, is that thyroid hormone is just made at the gland and it magically diffuses into the cells and tissues, and it's always going to get converted to the optimal form and bind to the receptor. And that's nice thinking if you think the cells and tissues don't have any control. But if it was just about what the gland produced, then when the gland produced goes through its ebbs and flows and surges of thyroid hormone, then every system in the body should be upregulated at the same point in time. And there shouldn't be, there wouldn't be any individual control of our separate tissues, right? So if I eat and I'm working, if my digestion's upregulated, then everything else should be upregulated at the same time. If my muscles are upregulated, then my bowels should be upregulated at the same time, right? So if I'm going to go for a run, then I should be shitting myself at the same time because my bowels are releasing, right? So we know in the science, and all the cells and tissues get to regulate themselves independently to a large degree of what's the thyroid gland does. How do we know that? Because you can take out somebody's thyroid gland like you, and we can put the thyroid hormone back in. And if everything else is working, then thyroid gland, the liver can work when it needs to work. The GI tract can work and needs to work. The metabolism of all these cells and tissues is not all upregulated at the same time and all downregulated at the same time. Otherwise, there's no way you would sleep, because at night, when the liver and other tissues are busy rebuilding, regenerating, and have an upregulation of their metabolism, then our brain would be up and busy and doing stuff. And our muscles would be busy and twitching and doing stuff, right? And that's not really the case that happens. So what we've learned over time is that cells and tissues have the ability to self-regulate, because there's different what we call receptors, things that the hormone binds to. Not all the receptors that the hormone binds to are the same from cell type to cell type to cell type. And so different cells have different receptors that have more sensitive or less sensitive. The brain has receptors that are more sensitive to thyroid hormone than a lot of other tissues. It's like a 10-fold more sensitive at the brain than a lot of peripheral tissues, which is a big deal, because a little bit of thyroid hormone shift in the bloodstream can impact the brain pretty quickly. But the peripheral tissues, maybe not so much. But once that thyroid hormone's in the bloodstream, there are different transport mechanisms to get it from the bloodstream into the tissue that are different between tissue types. There's some cells have deiodinase 1, some cells have deiodinase 2, some have deiodinase 3, and some of them don't have some of those. And the concentrations of the amount of those things can be different. So the transport mechanisms to get thyroid hormone in the cell differ from tissue type to tissue type. The converting enzymes inside the cell differ from tissue type to tissue type, and the receptors inside the cells differ from tissue type to tissue type. So there's no way that every cell and tissue regulates without some tissue control. And if that's the case, then we have to assume that we could have a tissue or a cell not have appropriate thyroid hormone status, because all of these regulate differently. And the other thing we have to keep in mind is what drives hypothyroid or hyperthyroid symptoms is not what's in the blood stream per se. It is the amount of T3 that's hitting a tissue. So if I have reduced T3 at this receptor in a cell and tissue, that's what creates the signs and symptoms. It's not necessarily what's in the blood. So I could have high amounts or normal amounts of T4 or T3 in the blood, but it's not inside the cell. So I could still have hypothyroid signs and symptoms. Mm-hmm. The challenge is we don't have great tools at this point to measure directly what's inside the cells and tissues. So as often, you know, in many situations, what's able to get measured gets managed. So if we can't measure it, it doesn't matter. And so people are like, oh, it can't happen. We just put it in and it's going to work. But we know this with lots of medications, that just because we put them in the system doesn't mean it's going to work. Why do we need more than, you know, people take multiple blood pressure medications? Hey, that worked and now it doesn't work. Right? Why? Because it has a different effect, and it has that effect at the tissue levels that change the physiology. So the other part of that is there is so much clinical research that shows that what's happening in the cell, that there is such a thing as reduced tissue levels of thyroid hormone status, that there's tissue hypothyroidism, that there's cellular hypothyroidism. This is not a new concept. I think I talk about it in the book. When I started writing the book, the concept was 20 years old, but nobody pays attention to what's happening at the cell and tissue level.
And we're really missing the mark by not doing that. I feel like.
Absolutely.
Like you said, how can we measure this? And you brought up what's in the bloodstream is not really the best marker for what the person is actually benefiting from with the hormone. And I see this, even my experience in conventional health with women's health, you know, testing blood hormone, you know, estrogen, progesterone, it really doesn't say anything for what's actually happening, right? And I'm thinking about their receptors themselves and what else could be binding to their receptors, which is why I am a huge fan of really paying attention to things that could be disrupting the endocrine system. Because for me, when I was in NP school, I had candles on my desk burning that delicious scent and aroma with a splitting migraine headache, never connecting the two together, and just in not even just chemicals that could be binding, but toxic thoughts. You mentioned hormones, stress hormones, and catecholamines. They could become elevated, right? Some of us, me for one, and lots of other people that I test a lot of, I'm a genetics nerd for sure, have that drain that has a potential to be clogged. And when I learned, when I really grasped this concept, it was life changing for me, that it wasn't about jamming more medication into me. It was about why don't we look at the whole picture and all of the different variables? Because the body is designed to survive and, like you said, adapt. So if we're maladapting, we need to figure why we're maladapting versus just, you know, take a bunch of thyroid supplements. Everybody needs selenium, don't they? And sometimes somebody's taking over 600 milligrams of selenium a day. You know, if they just eat more Brazil nuts, they're going to feel better, right? Not, okay, yeah, we need these cofactors. They matter, but we need to cast a wider net. It's more than just one nutrient or a supplement, or is it a conversion issue, or is it, you know, the gland not making enough, or if you don't have a gland, are you just not taking enough? But everything else that's in that soup, like our whole body, is going to play a role. And when we intervene in one area, it will have a downstream effect. Maybe it'll be positive, maybe it'll be negative, but everywhere in the body, which I think is really fascinating, but it can be frustrating for the listeners. I know it's frustrating because I was that individual, like suffering for, like, I feel like for years, not even barely being able to get up, get out of bed. And I had Raynaud's beforehand, but it went like crazy where in the summertime, whenever all day, my fingertips were just like white or blue, and my toes, and such pain. And it really had me think, like, ever since ever since they removed my thyroid, because is it really just the hormones? Is it just T4 and T3? I mean, there's more involved with that, because it's a system, right? With the body, and it's working with other systems in the body. It's not in isolation. So I feel like the frustration, the stress, just in both allopathic and functional medicine spaces, is how do we get somebody to feel better? I think everybody is looking for that answer, right? Mm-hmm. But looking at where is the lowest hanging fruit?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they're good points. And the answer is, it unfortunately often relies on the things that are simple strategies, but sometimes difficult to do, right? Like,
very difficult.
I've got to change my habits. Ooh, that's uncomfortable. It's simple to do, right? Simple to do. You just decide to do it. Like, I don't like to exercise. Okay. Well, but could you? Well, I don't. But could you? Well, I'm tired. Okay. But could you? I could. Okay, great. Then let's build a habit to do it. Well, I there's no way I could do. Can you do 30 seconds? Can you get up and do, you know, can you do 30 seconds of getting up and down? Yeah. Okay. Great. Let's do 30 seconds today. And every week you increase it by 30 seconds. Could you do that? Could you? I could. Yeah, I probably, I, maybe. No, you could. Right. But we have to build in habits. And the challenge is that's a simple thing to do is build a positive health habit. But we make excuses and we discuss all the things that make us uncomfortable about it. I don't like going to the gym. I don't like lifting weights. It makes me sore. It makes the whatever, right? We make lots of excuses. And what we don't often realize is all the habits that we have that we're doing on a constant ongoing basis that are tearing our health down, that are negative influences on our overall health and well-being. And so changing these things that maybe make us feel good, spending 5 hours a day on Instagram or Facebook or social media, watching videos may make us feel good temporarily, but it prevents us from doing things that are actually going to help us change and improve our health and quality of life. So we want to look. Oh, yeah. So then we say, well, that's uncomfortable. How about a supplement? But really the low hanging fruit stuff is the stuff that almost everybody talks about and everybody agrees when you really, even if it's the person with the five secrets to kill candida, if you really look at what's going on with what they're really teaching, they're still probably talking to their clients like, you got to improve your qualities, the quality and quantity of sleep. You need to work on your breath and respiration. You got to work on the appropriate mindset. You've got to eat a relatively healthy diet, right? You've got to do some form of physical training on a regular basis. Like, these are just general, overall, healthy lifestyle habits. And if that's the low-hanging fruit. It doesn't cost you anything different typically. Maybe, matter of fact, it's oftentimes cheaper to do those things. But the problem is that many times people in your environment aren't doing them. And yeah. So to do something different than friends are doing doesn't feel good, or it's difficult because all my friends eat all that. So I, you know, it's uncomfortable. I don't want to do that. I want to eat with that too. Okay. But if you're looking for the low hanging fruit, that's it. Right. So the end of the day, the low hanging foundational things should always come first. But I think the nature for all of us is we want the quick fix. And I don't think especially when we're in crisis mode, right? Because you've had chronic crisis health issues. I've had crisis health issues. And in that moment, I mean, I think we all reach for give me something, right? Whether it's chronic pain, right? Give me something that's going to take it away. And it may help a little bit, but ultimately, if it's not addressing the root issue, it becomes a crutch and it becomes a problem. And I say the same thing about thyroid hormone strategies. And I had, you know, somebody in the space who's considered a thyroid expert. And we talked about this. And, you know, their thought process is that you always optimize the T4 and T3 in the blood and then do stuff. And to me,
backwards,
I'm like, that is not what if the body didn't want to convert T4 to T3 to begin with, why would putting more T3 in the system optimize them? Well, it makes them feel better. Well, if I gave you some cocaine today and let you snort it like crazy, you're probably going to feel good today, but tomorrow you probably won't. So you're going to say, well, I like that feeling I had yesterday with that two lines of cocaine. So now I'm going to go get some more cocaine and I'll do two lines. Oh, two lines didn't do it this time. Okay. I'm going to do three lines of cocaine or whatever the drug is. Right. And so now we see the same thing that people start on this journey of, let me incrementally increase the dose. In a situation maybe like you where, hey, I don't have a gland and I have a polymorphism, I'm going to need some T3. You probably will. But for the general public, if 80% of the people don't have a homozygous polymorphism that slows that down by 20%, then we shouldn't be going there first, right? And if only 5 to 10 micrograms tops is made by the thyroid gland, we shouldn't be taking more than that and assuming we're going to necessarily fix the physiology. And as I said earlier, there's a downside to it. There's a couple downsides. One, if the person's already got that fight or flight response, we overload the brain with thyroid hormone, which then suppresses TSH, and then reduce this thyroid gland production further, which has happened to my example I gave you. Yes. And then the other thing is they're, if they're already in that stress response, it further decreases the T4 to T3 conversion. So now in a short period of time, it starts, the person hits their plateau or what I call the stall, and now they're increasing the dose. They're a junkie for T4 or T3 medications, and they're never happy. So I think trying to optimize the blood level to a lab standard of optimal range is ridiculous. What we need to do when we're working with somebody who is on thyroid medication is, at least my opinion and bias, is that they should take the least amount of thyroid hormone necessary to maintain a level of stability, but not be problematic, not override the system. And if it is a person that we're trying to get to recover the thyroid, their thyroid gland function, we can't be suppressing TSH into the 1 to 2 range, because then they'll never recover their thyroid gland, because we're providing more medication. We're essentially atrophying the gland. And so when I'm working with somebody and we're reducing medication dose, their medical doctor may be like, well, your TSH is now 5. That's not good. Oh, it is good. Please have her take a look at your T4 and T3. Your TSH, when it was 1.2 on your dose, your free T4 was 1.4, but your free T3 was 2.1. When we reduced the dose, from 100 to 88, your T4, total T4 may have stayed the same or went down, but your total T3 and free T3 went up and the conversion got better. So the less medication and the higher TSH actually helps us recover a thyroid gland, which is why the allopathic community says, once you have thyroiditis, it's not coming back. Once you're on medication, you're going to be on it forever. That's true based on their model, because they're replacing what a gland often would make and suppressing the gland. In functional medicine, if we're doing the same thing, but using a combination of T4 and T3, then we become a slave to the medication. And you'll hear people say, well, I do good. I just have to take really high doses of medication to be optimized. Well, then you're not optimized, right? If you're taking super physiologic doses of thyroid hormone to maintain some fantasy optimal level, then you're not optimal, right? If you need thyroid replacement therapy at super physiologic doses, and then you need sex hormones optimized to get you optimized, and then you're starting to work on the things that are driving the cell stress response and your signs and symptoms, man, I think that's a bad place to do. Sure, we can band-aid them, but I think it's a terrible strategy to help restore health.
I agree. 150%. And I agree with band-aids, temporary band-aids, because I don't want somebody to feel bad. I don't want to feel bad. And I was definitely on the bandwagon of give me whatever will help me to feel better. I wish I knew years beforehand what was going on with me and the things I know now, which of course I can't go back in time, because maybe I would have had an impact on my gland, wouldn't have went down the road I went down, developing autoimmunity, and just told it's just genetic. And I literally had a doctor tell me, you can't run from your genes. And, both of my parents died in their 50s. I'm turning 50 this year. And I'm told I'm hopeless. Well, this was years ago, but told I'm hopeless. And that is not a message I would ever want to send anybody. So all the listeners out there, nobody is hopeless. It's, I believe, really getting to the roots of what the situation is and looking at the whole picture. Right? It's not just, I have low estrogen, give me estrogen. My thyroid's not functioning well, give me thyroid hormone. Whatever the situation is, it's what is your body's response to your lifestyle? And I was the queen of bad habits. And I'm very transparent with my clients that I was the one in nursing school eating Skittles and a Three Musketeer bar for lunch and drinking soda and thinking, well, I don't have any issues right now. I'm fine, right? And not thinking about the impact, like the nutritional deficiencies I had and the leading to hormonal issues and migraines and, here, take this pill, Tara, take this pill. And I tried all these things and nothing worked, right? It wasn't until for me, it was the nervous system work that was the biggest game changer for me. I used to say, I just can't calm down Well, no, I couldn't, especially not with that mindset, right? Mm-hmm. I have a genetic predisposition to not calm down and to be hyped up, all those fancy terms that everybody throws out, and they'll tell me they have MTHFR. I'm like, okay, which, what variant? Because it matters. And it doesn't mean you're broken. Your body is still able to do what it's supposed to do, or you wouldn't be alive, right? So it's,
yeah.
I think that if there was like a bubble, maybe I'll insert one right here, like over us, like thought for the day, it would be, we are survivors, right? Not designed to self-destruct. So how right. can we clear the terrain, you know, reduce the load, lower the threshold? What can, are there steps that we can take that are free, right? That can have the biggest impact, even though they're hard. And again, oh, yeah. I didn't want to do any of those things. So I didn't get better or just yeah. slightly better. It took doing these things that were hard, but then it's life changing. And now they're not so hard most of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're simple things to do. And it can be difficult, but like creating, you know, we talk about habitual fitness, like what are your habits? What are you doing? And slowly and consistently making some of those changes. And I would say, you know, we talk about these in the book, we call them the fitness factors, you know, emotional fitness, brain fitness. We talk about physical fitness, dietary fitness, sleep fitness, respiratory fitness. And you may not be able to figure out everything that's going on, especially when we talk about microbes and metabolic fitness, but the other things you can address. But I would say one of the biggest things across the board that creates problems for people and continues that cell stress response, that cell danger response, is two. One, they've been under perceived, real or perceived stress for so long that they just have limbic wind up. They're hypervigilant. And if they have, and that can turn out to feel like anxiousness or anxiety, right? Because you're releasing those chemicals. And if you have it slow, let's say your detoxification pathways are compromised. And let's say you're the person that has a comp gene that, you know, just is by nature is a slower, you clear it slower. And yeah, and you're female and it's your menstrual cycle. Like there's a lot of things that can cause those fight or flight hormones to stay in the system longer and keep hitting receptors and trigger those symptoms. But the emotional, the input that we've done over years creates this limbic windup, I believe, and keeps us, even though the real threat is gone, many times the body's still acting as if the threat is still there. And usually the analogy I give, if somebody broke into your home and attacked you, the police came and arrested them, would you go back to normal everyday life tomorrow? It may take you weeks or months to convince your brain that you're no longer in danger before you chill back out again. And that's, you know, that's an adaptive response. But if we're constantly putting input in, whether it's real input, whether it's a bad relationship or bad thought process or mindset, mm-hmm. right? Then we're continuing the wind up. And I think one of the things that happens to a lot of our clients is they're the ones that are making a lot of changes. They are so wound up by, I can't eat this. I can't do that. This has got me. I can't be around mold. I'm reactive to this. I'm toxic to that. This is this. And so the thing that's keeping them into a cell stress response is their goal for optimization and perfection and their fear of everything. I can't eat that. Now, I'm not advocating that you just eat terrible, but just this inbound fear that everything is going to get you. My body's attacked me. Toxins are all around me. The mold's in here, right? I think I have a parasite. I always have parasites. You can't even tell we're parasites. And that thought process continues to reinforce the limbic windup. And for a lot of people, this is not sometimes the conversation that they're willing to hear on day one.
No.
But sometimes once you start getting some, really have a good rapport with them, you can say, look, I know you've done a gut protocol 10 times already, right? With three different providers. You've tried detox, you can't lose weight, nothing seems to work. When nothing seems to work for somebody, that's usually when we really start to have that, what's going on from a brain perspective, is what's going on just a really big limbic windup. And there's real perceived chronic threat responses. And if we don't address it, they don't get better. But sometimes the big flu for somebody is just going on vacation. Mm-hmm. And so the person who can't eat anything anywhere, and they're always toxic and they're always stressed and they can't sleep and everything else. And then they go on vacation to the islands, let's say, for 4 days. They eat food they haven't eaten in a long time. They drink a bunch of alcohol. They're doing less. They're not as on top of and worried about everything. And they're like, I didn't have any sleeping problems. I had no anxiety. I ate terrible, but I didn't have any GI issues. I drank alcohol and I didn't really feel bad at all. Like, and then I came back and everything comes back. I'm like, right. Because what happened when you were away? You relaxed, right? And so we're not often aware of the daily perceptions of our environment and how it really winds up our system until sometimes we go away. And I would mm-hmm. say one more point on that, like me included, I'm an avid hunter and I took up archery hunting a number of years ago. And when I first started archery hunting, you sit and stand like for 6, 8, 10 hours, right? Sometimes 12 hours in a day, waiting all day. And I would, the first couple times I went, like I'm a half hour, and I'm going, man, I got stuff to do. Like, what am I doing here? Like, I felt so guilty. And I got all of these thoughts coming into my brain while I'm sitting there, like telling me, get up and go do this. You got to do that. You got to do this. Got to do that. And that became really, that was a big aha moment for me. Like, man, if I can't sit here with my own thoughts without anxiousness and anxiety, I need to work on it. And I'm not a person who's going to sit in the middle of the floor and chant and do, like meditate. But that is that's a huge meditation for me. And I realized that the longer I sat there without my phone, without social media, all that stuff, there's a lot of noise going on there. And just being out in the wilderness, in the outdoors with nature, not focused on social media, all that stuff comes in, and then then pushing it back out again or dealing with those thoughts was a huge benefit for me. Huge relaxation in my physiology. You know, some of the symptomatology that I thought that wasn't a big necessarily big deal, but Raynaud's, like that was a worse issue for me before, less of it. Why? Well, I wasn't even aware of how all of that input was impacting my conscious and subconscious until I had to be alone with myself. And I think that's a huge issue for a lot of us. We spend so much time in front of these things, bombarding our brains with other people's input, that we don't pay attention to what's going on between the 6 inches of our ears and how that and what we're inputting is impacting our nervous system, our limbic system, and creating a potential chronic stress response. So I'm not advocating everybody go archery hunting, but you need to be able to have time where you can really sit back and realize, like, what's going on up here? Like, are they positive thoughts? Are they negative thoughts? Am I worried about things all the time? And really start to work on that muscle, the brain muscle, and be able to manage those things. We should be able to do that naturally as the upper brain develops. But I think what we do through life a lot of times is just really over-exercise that limbic system to the point that many of us are just living in a chronic state of hypervigilance. Mm-hmm. And we're shocked then, or we don't realize that hypervigilance is causing hypothyroidism. It's causing the underconversion. It's causing a terrain that allows for bacteria and yeast and things to overgrow. It's creating an environment that causes us to have to store fat and rely on sugar for energy. So if I had to have a final like tip for somebody, that would be it. I wasn't open to that for a while myself, but you get older, you get wiser, and you realize that this, what goes on up here, may really truly have the biggest global impact on our physiology. And really, it's like anything else. You have to constantly work on building a better brain and a better, psychology, a better mentality. If you really want to be healthy, get healthy, stay healthy, and maintain health, you can't ignore that piece of it.
Absolutely. And for the people in the back of the room, take note of what Dr. Eric just said, because that's can be life altering. And I feel your story likely resonates with many, definitely with me. I could not quiet the noise. That's definitely a huge clinical pearl that you just gave all of the listeners. And I know we're over time and I want to be mindful of your time. Is there anything we haven't talked about? Anything you feel my listeners would benefit from?
Oh, I'm sure we could talk for more days, but yes. If somebody wants more, I guess if they want more of this kind of conversation, obviously I've got my podcast, The Thyroid Answers Podcast. I have the book out with my friend Kelly Halderman called The Thyroid Debacle. And then I'm not a big social media person myself, but I do use social media to put out some, you know, thoughts and teachings and comments. I have my Thyroid Thursday videos, which are more educational. I don't do any singing. I don't do any dancing. I don't do any neat caption things. My purpose of those things is to answer the questions a lot of people send me and to try and help educate people as to, okay, this is what somebody said, but here's the reality. This is what somebody said, but here's how physiology actually works. Here's what somebody told you you need to do, but maybe that's not the right answer, right? So really try and do as much education as possible. So that's what those would be the things I'd say.
Well, I'm going to link to all of that in the show notes. And definitely, I recommend getting the book. I'm really glad that I finally read it. I've been hearing about it for a while, but I finally got it and read it. Definitely worth reading. And I could easily speak to you for hours, and we'll have to have you back on the show and continue this conversation and dive into other topics. This has been truly a pleasure.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. Come on.
And on that note, I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Drop me a comment and let me know what you think. If you learned something today, share this episode with a friend, family member, or coworker. If you're not already subscribed to the show, hit that follow button along with the notification bell so you never miss an episode. I've got a great year ahead of episodes coming your way. If you have an idea for a show, follow the links in the show notes. I would love to hear from you. If you're not receiving my newsletter, click the link in the show notes so you can be added to the list. Every Friday, I send out tips, tricks, information that truly matters. Follow the link so you don't miss out. So many of you have reached out to me wanting to work with me. Some have even signed up for a free consult through my website. And while I have thoroughly enjoyed reading your emails and meeting you through my telehealth platform, if you do not currently live in Indiana, I am not at the liberty to be your healthcare practitioner at this time. I am in the process of creating educational material that can transcend state and international lines in the form of masterclasses. I'm looking to bring into the fold a certified nutrition counselor and a certified yoga instructor. There will be special beta pricing as the curriculum develops. There is a waitlist, and I recommend if you're interested, click the link in the show notes. I am very passionate about health and wellness, getting optimized. I have been on my own wellness journey for quite some time and want to bring as many people with me on this journey towards better health. Thanks so much for spending time with me today, and I will see you very soon. Bye, friends.